Satrajit murdered. The jewel returned. This is Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 57. I'm going to read several verses. Interesting, this is on the same topic as this evening. The discussion that's taking place is mental speculation on the part of the residents of Dwarka, speculating why it is that there's irregularity of weather and similar conditions in Dwarka. Because wherever Krishna, we know from the first canto of the Bhagavatam, described by Kunti in her beautiful prayers, that when Krishna was present on this planet, everything was bountiful just by his lotus feet touching Mother Earth. Mother Earth supplied everything in full. And sufficient rainfall, so there was adequate agricultural production. The hills are producing jewels and minerals and all necessities of life in abundance. So what to speak of when Krishna was on earth, this was the situation. Here Krishna is living in Dwarka. And lo and behold, there's irregularities in Dwarka. And diseases and illnesses that just were unknown before. So although the residents of Dwarka are great devotees of the Lord, at least in this section, they're speculating. Devotees don't do that, but they were doing that. And they were considering that the irregularities were due to the absence of a Krura. And they're citing the history where the father of Akura, whose name was Shvapalka, had gone to visit Benares at a time when in Benares there was an extended drought. No, thank you. There was an extended drought. And by Svafalka's presence, sufficient rainfall. And so Svapalka was attributed with the quality of being able to bring rain and regularity of the weather. And the king was so pleased with Svapalka that he gave his daughter in marriage to Svapalka, the king of Kashi. Benares. And the child born of Svapalka and the daughter of the king of Kashi was Akura. So the speculation going on here is they thought, like father, like son. When Akura was present in Dwarka, everything was very regular and very nice. Akura has gone. Therefore, there's irregularities. Again, speculation, but that's what they're doing here. Text 33 from chapter 57. Translation. Wherever his equally powerful son Akura stays, Lord Indra will provide sufficient rain. Indeed, that place will be free of miseries and untimely deaths, like a good luck charm or something. text is text 34. Hearing these words from the elders, Lord Janardana, Krishna, though aware that the absence of Akura was not the only cause of the evil omens, he had him summoned back to Dwarka. The reason that Akura left was he was part of a murder plot. Akura and Kritavarma had plotted to get the Jamataka jewel back from Satrajit. We're going to be hearing about this evening. So, the jewel was gifted to Satrajit by Suryadeva, the sun god. Satrajit was killed as a result of the murder plot with the involvement of Akura and Kritavarma. So when Krishna came back to Dwarka, because he was out of station, he came back. Kritavarma ran for his life, and Akura left with the Shamantaka jewel, and he went to Kashi, his ancestral home. So the citizens were going, "Hey, what's going on? What's going on? There's irregularities in Dwarka. It must be because Akura has left." So Krishna, being omniscient, he knew that wasn't the reason. So he then sent a messenger to Kashi requesting Akura to come to Dwarka and speak with him. And how Krishna speaks with him is very interesting, because Krishna knew who had killed his father-in-law because he's omniscient. But he didn't even mention that. You'll hear what he says. The relationship between Krishna and Akura is very puzzling, or amazing, or very deep and difficult to understand. Purport. Since Lord Krishna is the supreme controller, it was obviously by his will that certain troubles appeared in the city of Dwarka. Superficially, these evils may have been caused by Akura's absence, and also by the absence of the auspicious Shamantaka jewel. But we should recall that Dwarka is the eternal abode of Lord Krishna. It is a city of divine bliss because the Lord resides there. Still, to execute his pastimes as a prince of this world, Lord Krishna did the needful and summoned Akura. Text 36. Lord Krishna honored Akura. He's his elder. So Krishna is showing by his example the culture of honoring one's elders. Greeted him confidentially and spoke pleasant words with him. Then the Lord, who was fully aware of Akura's heart by virtue of being the knower of everything, smiled and addressed him, "O Master of Charity," he's going to ask him for something, "surely the opulent Shamantaka jewel was left in your care by Shatadanva." He's the one that did the murder. And he gave the jewel to Akura. And Krishna's speaking like by inductive logic. "Surely you have the jewel, and it is still with you. Indeed, we have known this all along." And the reason that Krishna knew by inductive, rather than stating his omniscience, he's stating the logic, because Ranakura was in Kashi, he was worshipping the jewel. And the jewel had this benediction from the sun god that one who worships the jewel will receive 70 pounds of gold every day. So Akura had this opulent temple and everything made of gold and gold, 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 gold. So Krishna said, I know you have the jewel. And I've known this all along. So he's also indicating his omniscience. Purport. Lord Krishna's treatment of Akura here confirms that he is actually a great devotee of the Lord. Next translation, text 37. Since Satrajit has no sons, his daughter's sons should receive his inheritance. Krishna is pointing to tradition. So Satrajit owned the jewel. Now Satrajit had no sons, but Satyabhama is the daughter of Satrajit. So the sons of the daughter of a person becomes the inheritor of the property of the person. Grandsons, not sons. But the sons of the daughter should inherit the property of grandfather. They should pay for memorial offerings of water and pinda, clear their grandfather's outstanding debts, and keep the remainder of the inheritance for themselves. Another cultural point. When you inherit from someone their assets, you also inherit their debts. So they have these three duties. One, in the absence of sons, then the grandsons perform the shraddha, or offering of pinda to the forefathers. This is a duty of the sons or the grandsons. So it's their duty to offer pinda on behalf of their grandfather, it's also their duty to clear his debts, and then they are in turn entitled to the balance, whatever that is. This is the law. Just citing law. Purport. Srila Sridhar Swami quotes the following Smriti injunction regarding inheritance. Patni duhitarash chaiva pitaro bharat bratharas tata tatsuta gotraja bandhu shishyasa brahmanachara brahmanacharana. Brahmacharanya, brahmacharinaha. The inheritance goes first to the wife, then, if the wife has passed away, to the daughters, then to the parents, then to the brothers' sons, then to family members of the same gotra as the deceased, and then to his disciples, including brahmacharis. Paragraph. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti adds that since Satrajit had no sons, since his wives were killed together with him, and since his daughter Satyabhama was not interested in the Shamataka jewel, which constituted the inheritance, it rightfully belonged to her sons. Paragraph. In Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Srila Prabhupada explains, quote, Lord Krishna indicated by this statement that Satyabhama was already pregnant and that her son would be the real claimant of the jewel and would certainly take the jewel from Akura if he tried to conceal it. Very complicated intrigue here. So Krishna continues speaking to Akura. Text 38-39. Nevertheless, the jewel should remain in your care, O trustworthy Akura, because no one else can keep it safely. But please, show the jewel just once, since my elder brother does not fully believe what I have told him about it. Balaram, this is the elder brother. In this way, O most fortunate one, you will pacify my relatives. Then in brackets, everyone knows you have the jewel, for you are now continually performing sacrifices on altars of gold. Purport. Although technically Satyabhama's sons had a right to the jewel, Lord Krishna decided to leave the jewel in the care of Akura, who was using the jewel's wealth to continually perform religious sacrifices. Indeed, Akura's ability to perform such rituals on altars of gold was an indication of the jewel's potency. Text 40. Thus, shamed by Lord Krishna's conciliatory words, the son of Shvapalka brought out the jewel from where he had concealed it in his clothing and gave it to the Lord. The brilliant gem shone like the sun. Purport. We can see in this chapter how a valuable jewel caused so much intrigue, violence, and suffering. This is certainly a good lesson for those who desire a trouble-free spiritual life. Just two more verses in the chapter. We'll finish the chapter. Text 41. After the Almighty Lord had shown the Shamataka jewel to his relatives, thus dispelling the false accusations against him, he returned it to Akura. Purport. For the second time, doubts about the Lord's reputation occasioned by the Shamataka jewel are dispelled by the jewel itself. Indeed, for the second time, the Lord brought the jewel to Dwarka to establish his integrity there. This amazing series of incidents demonstrates that even when Lord Krishna descends to this world, there is a tendency for his, quote, peers to criticize him. The whole material world is infected by the fault-finding propensity. And in this chapter, the Supreme Lord demonstrates the nature of this undesirable quality. And the final text, 42. This narration, rich with descriptions of the prowess of Sri Vishnu, Lord Sri Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, removes sinful reactions and bestows all auspiciousness. Anyone who recites, hears, or remembers it will drive away his own infamy and sins and attain peace. So that's a good reason to study this section of Srimad Bhagavatam. The benediction offered at the end by Shukadeva Goswami is it's appropriate for any kind of spiritual sound vibration. Spiritual sound vibration has potency, just like in the Ajamila story in the sixth canto of the Bhagavatam. By his even inadvertently calling the name of Narayana, same thing. So whether it's just that is all all sins are eradicated, the reactions of sins are eradicated. One is brought to a protected position, and that protected position, that's where the position of peace is, not otherwise. Because otherwise, we're completely vulnerable at every moment from all directions. One of the kindnesses of Krishna is to, like we were discussing yesterday evening, burst that bubble when the sense of shelter and safety in something that's temporary and illusory, the temporary and illusory thing disappears, and then the realization is you didn't have shelter after all. And when the false shelters are taken away, then the opportunity to take genuine shelter is encouraged. So there's this saying, even in foxholes, there are no atheists. It's a military term when there's fighting this side against that side, and they make a bunker, something that protects them. They can hide behind, and the bullets are coming, and they're in this like trench thing, and everyone's praying to God. When there's danger, the tendency to pray to God becomes stronger. And when there's the appearance of no danger, and instead I have these enjoyable objects and situations and things and relationships and everything is nice, tendency for prayer diminishes. Like Prabhupada described this in terms of America. He was specific about it, that many of the Hare Krishna temples in the beginning, when we began, initially it was just renting places, renting the storefront or renting a house and conducting programs in the house. But when it got to the point of purchasing property, a number of the properties in the beginning were churches, like the Los Angeles Temple. Prabhupada often spoke about that. Or the Montreal Temple or the Toronto Temple. Big stone, beautiful churches. And the New York City Temple was a previous one, was a Catholic facility. The present one was a synagogue, a Jewish facility. Anyway, Prabhupada made the point that America was founded on religious freedom. People left Europe to come to America to worship God in their own way because they were being oppressed in Europe, so they came for religious freedom purposes. And when they came through that religious freedom, they established places of worship. The Houston Temple is another example. It was a little church. They have a temple in the Chicago suburbs was a Baptist church. So places were built for religious expression of religious freedom. And through that worship and their hard work, people began to prosper. And then the reason for going to the church became less. Like Krishna describes in Bhagavad Gita, the four types of pious people that render devotional service unto me. Those in distress, or those wanting economic betterment, or those who are curious, or those who are searching for knowledge, or situated in knowledge, they engage in my devotional service. But if it's the other, if one doesn't have this higher motive or higher purpose, then taking shelter of Krishna is expedient only. I take shelter of Krishna because I want something. And when I get that something, it's thank you very much, Krishna, see you later. Until there's another, I want something, and then I go back to Krishna. It's utilitarian, or expedient, or based upon my own interest. So part of the life of devotion, as described in the Srimad Bhagavatam, is to regularly hear Srinvatasva Kata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtana Hridyantak Stolyabhadrani Vidhunoti Suritsatam Nashtaprayeshu Abhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. One should regularly hear, not just I want something, or I'm in distress, or for purification, like discussing the devotee couple yesterday evening. Chanting because I want something, or even I like it, it feels good, is one kind, but then it's meant to purify me. That's a more sustainable, it's a mode of goodness purpose. So regularly we should hear. And by regularly hearing, we're protected. We have shelter of Krishna, and shelter of Krishna means sinful reactions are eradicated. Nashta prayeshu abhadreshu. The abhadras, the impurities of heart, are nashta by the process of hearing about Krishna. And since this pastime is specific about coveting material asset, as happens in this world, it's the name of the game. People are born into this world owning nothing. They leave this world owning nothing. And in between, very, very busy trying to make so many things mine. And if you make lots of things yours, you're considered successful. Those persons of this world that have affluence, great wealth, they're, regardless of the means by which they got that wealth, commonly, they're revered. Somebody has great, 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 great wealth. They're a great person simply because they have great wealth. They're not a great person simply because they have great wealth, but that's the worldly perspective. But in the course of living, there are things inadvertently, perhaps even deliberately, that are done that are wrong. And so how do you deal with that? Religions differ. One of the ways in which religions differ is the answer to that question. So here's the question. Just by living in this world, just by existing, there is going to be some actions that are bringing suffering and misery or inconvenience to others. Just by existing. You drink water. You eat. You walk across, the floor. And, you exist. And other living beings are suffering, or they're being, their lives or their well-being are being sacrificed by our existing. So we're responsible for that. The sufferings of others we're responsible for. And then there's laws of nature and laws of God, and we may inadvertently violate them, and we're responsible for them. And the whole idea of what do you do about the reactions that come as a result of all of that? Either directly sins or just unintentional violations of other person's well-being. And the answer to what do you do about that makes up religions. Some religions say this and that. You believe in this doctrine or this person or this teaching, you're freed. Or you do this ritual, those rituals, and you're freed from the prayaschitta is a Sanskrit term. And it's not just, Vedas have prayaschitta. All religions have some form of atonement for sins. One form or another form. And the varieties of at least the rituals and also the convictions vary accordingly. So, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's addressed in this way. It's a very nice section of Srimad Bhagavatam, where at the end of the fifth canto, cosmology is presented, Vedic picture of cosmology, the structure of the universe. It's really technical, very, very elevated, but it paints the picture of same as other religions, higher planets, intermediate planets, and the lower planets. No, there's heaven and there's hell, and there's this place. And above us is heaven, and below us is hell. All religions have that notion. The Vedas just describe it in greater, greater, greater detail. Bhagavatam is, you know, very detailed. And it ends with a description of the lower planets, the hellish planets. And fifth canto ends. So sixth canto begins with Maharaj Parikshit saying basically, oh my God, the suffering condition in the hellish planets is so great. What can be done to relieve people of the reactions for their sins that may then take them to the hellish planets? Because it's not just it's a bad place. There's different categories of hell and they're described. You read the description, it's awful. It's awful. Incredible suffering. Corresponding with the sins, the degrees of the sins and the nature of the sins, there's particular hellish planets or places. So, how to relieve people from reactions of their sins is the question. And that's a theological question that different religions have different answers to. Makes up the religion. So, believe in this or do that or follow these practices, rituals under the guidance of a qualified person. Offer your prayers so many times a day or whatever the procedure is, and it will relieve you of sin. So the way that the Bhagavatam addresses it, rather than saying this one, that one, the other one, it's speaking in terms of principle. Like sometimes, not sometimes, often, we hear Prabhupada describe the Bhagavatam as a spiritual science. It's not an ism or a belief system. Rather, it's describing principle. It's a science, and you take this principle and apply it, or that principle and apply it, or the other principle and apply it, and like a science, Prabhupada would describe like this. There's hypothesis, and then after hypothesis, this is a scientific method. Hypothesis, experiment, observations, conclusions, right? That's a scientific method. So I postulate something. To demonstrate the something, here's an experiment. And anybody can do it. You don't have to believe or not believe. You don't have to be, you know, no prior qualification. Anybody, everybody can do. Here's the experiment. You're going to get the certain result every time. That's scientific. And then conclusion. Therefore, scientific method. Prabhupada described, the Vedas are presented that way. The process of devotional service is part of that spiritual science. So within the Vedas, not this religion, that religion, but they're the principle of karmakanda, jnanakanda, and bhakti, or worshipping the personality of Godhead. So that's outlined. One time I'll go through the detail of how the Bhagavatam describes this sixth canto, but it's very important. When there's atonement, that's the karmakanda section, if there are some rituals and you make some mistake in the rituals, there's some process of atonement or prayaschitta at the end of all rituals. It's part of the ritual. And the purpose of that is, if there has been some mistake in the ritual, it's neutralized, the reaction for the mistake in the ritual. Or life. If you live your life according to the guidance of the Vedas, then there's processes of prayaschitta, or atoning for the mistakes, inadvertent mistakes in life. That must be there. in the karmakanda process. It is there. However, it's insufficient because you may atone for some sin, some wrongdoing, and then it neutralizes the reaction. But the tendency to do the same thing again remains. So then it moves to the next category, and that's jnana kanda. If you know better, it reduces the tendency. And if you thoroughly know better, knowledge will guide your life instead of ignorance guiding life. So tendency is greatly reduced, but still tendency will come out. Less likely, but it will still come out. And so the recommendation that's being presented in the Bhagavatam is Bhagavad Dharma, or hearing the glories of the Supreme Lord. I'm just emphasizing this final verse in the section, because it says, by hearing this description, all these wonderful things will come. What the Bhagavatam says specifically is not only the reaction is removed and not only one becomes situated in knowledge, but the very tendency, the root cause, the tendency is removed by the process of Bhagavad Dharma. Now what's the tendency that is the root cause? The tendency is seeking enjoyment apart from Krishna. Basic. Really basic. So, Jiva Goswami describes it in this way. Jiva Goswami puts forward the following premise. If you know how we got into the material condition of life, then you can understand how to get out of the material condition of life. Very logical. Like, we, most of us anyway, entered the temple room through that door. So since we came in through the door, that's the way out. There's a big, nice big exit sign right there. That's how you get out. And that's the way we come in too. So how did we come into the material world? That tells you how to get out of the material world. And this is in Bhakti Sandarbha. So then he proposes. Some people say this, some people say that, some people say the other thing. Then he analyzes this, that, and the other thing and refutes them on the authority of Scripture. And then says the reason we came into the... Then he presents another option, which is we came into the material world, the material condition of life, because we turned our attention away from Krishna. Bahir Mukhajeev is his phrase. Like, if you look at the sun, you don't see shadow. And you turn your face from the sun, you see shadow. So trying to find happiness by adjusting the shadow, that's not how you find happiness. It's returning to the source of light, right? The real happiness of the living entity is acting in relation to the supreme happiness, to the supreme pure, to the Satchitananda Vigraha, the personality of Godhead who is full of bliss and knowledge eternally. That's our real happiness. Until we address that, we're not going to find happiness. We'll find ourselves in the material condition of life. So, what is being said here in this last verse of this purport, this chapter, is just hearing the topics of Krishna. It's purifying, but more than purifying, it takes away the very root cause of our material existence, which is the attention turned away from Krishna. Turn your attention to Krishna. The root cause is uprooted. There's potency in the messages of Krishna. And specific to this pastime, it's the envy of Satrajit toward Krishna, because Krishna was living in Dwaraka, the city of opulence, Aishwarya. But he became so enamored with the opulent Shamantaka jewel he just completely ignored Krishna. In fact, he offended Krishna. Krishna didn't take offense. But anyway, so many difficulties arose due to not just having the jewel, but forgetting Krishna because of having the jewel and becoming, well, goo-goo gaga about the jewel, completely enamored by the opulence, material opulence, thus forgetting Krishna. So, better to not have the jewel. Well, that was arranged. It was taken from him. But because of the offense to Krishna, more than just losing the jewel, he lost his life. The situation with Akura was different because Akura didn't forget Krishna. He was attached to Krishna, as the purport is saying. How Krishna spoke to him indicates very clearly how dear Akura was to Krishna and how dear Krishna was to Akura. In the stealing of the Shamantaka jewel from Satrajit, there's some very amazing commentary by our acharyas. I'll discuss that a little more this evening. But one of the motives was Satrajit didn't do what Krishna wanted. Krishna specifically approached Satrajit. This is his father-in-law. And said, opulence such as this should be given to the king. He didn't ask it for himself. He asked, please give the jewel to Ugrasena. And what was Satrajit's reply?
No.
He wanted the jewel. He wanted the gold from the jewel. He wanted the prestige and whatever other things that people think having wealth will give them. He didn't want to let go of that. He had it. He didn't want to let go of it and give it to the king. Then that began a whole series of events where he started criticizing Krishna because the jewel was gone and his brother was gone and he was accusing Krishna. Rumoring. Krishna killed my brother. Krishna stole the jewel. Right in Dwaraka, right in Krishna's presence. So if it can happen in Dwaraka, in Krishna's presence, can it not happen here? In Kali Yuga? It happens. But it even happened in relation to Krishna. So it's mentioned in the purport that twice Krishna, the jewel was returned, given to Satrajit. So Krishna's name was cleared. And then the murder of Satrajit, the jewel was taken from Dwaraka, and irregularities appeared in Dwaraka. So again, Krishna was being criticized. Krishna has an issue with Akura. Akura left Dwaraka. Because Akura left Dwaraka, there's irregularities. Krishna did a bad thing. So Krishna corrected it through the very means itself, the jewel. Well, again, we'll discuss this evening in more detail. There's many, many lessons embedded in the Bhagavatam. Lessons of how we should lead our lives. Principles that should govern. Values that we should live our lives by. It's like what Prabhupada describes as for a train to proceed. Of course, now they have monorails, but a train to proceed, you have two tracks. And if you only have one out of the two tracks, the train isn't going to go very far. You need two tracks. Similarly, Prabhupada used that comparison to say, in spiritual life, two things must be present. One is that which will purify the heart, and the other is that which will guide your activity. So scripture is needed to guide your activity in the holy name, and the process of hearing spiritual sound vibration, Krishna Katha, it purifies the heart, exactly as being sent here. But simultaneously, supposing someone has something, a means that purifies them, but they're not guided by proper conduct, scriptural indication of proper conduct, it can lead to sentimentality, Prabhupada's words, or even fanaticism. And in this world, we know what happens. There's enough fanaticism to go around. Fanaticism is dangerous. Something that's purifying but without being properly guided, it can be dangerous. Or the other way, something that's just proper guidance without a heart that's pure isn't going to go very far. Well, that's a nice ideal, but I don't have the spiritual strength to do it. So the chant for our process, the chanting of the holy name is our principal means of cleansing the heart. Cheto darpana marjanam, making the heart pure through chanting. And then, side by side, how to lead our lives in accordance with the will of Krishna, and that which will please Krishna, that which will make Krishna smile. What can we do that will make Krishna smile upon our conduct? So he's smiling upon Akura, because fundamentally he has deep devotion for Krishna. We understand that Akura is, of the nine processes of bhakti, he achieved perfection through one of them, through offering prayer. Discussed it yesterday evening briefly. The prayers that he offered when he was in the river Jamuna bathing and he saw the spiritual world that Akura got. Very sacred place. So he's not an ordinary personality. He has great devotion for Krishna. He made Sudurachar, very, very bad activity. He killed Krishna's father-in-law. Well, he didn't do it. He, Shatadanva, did it. But he was put up to it by Kritavarma and Akura. Very bad. But how is Krishna dealing with him? He's dealing with him as a very dear personality. Speaking in, very clever ways. Oh, bestower of great charity. May I have the jewel? Just see it. I'll give it back to you. So that the thing would stop. The relatives and people in Dwarka could understand the reason for irregularities was not that Krishna had an issue with Akura and therefore Akura left. Here's the Shyamataka jewel, here's Akura, everything is nice. So he came back to Dwarka and resided there, worshipping the Shyamataka jewel. So more on the topic this evening. Any comments or questions? Can't hear you. Did who do what? Yes. To receive, before receiving the Shyamataka jewel, he worshipped the sun god. And then the sun god appeared and being pleased with him, he offered him this very, very, very special Shyamataka jewel and gave certain benedictions along with you worship the jewel and these things will happen. He was a worshipper of the sun god. Satrajit. the giving of his daughter to Krishna wasn't because of his devotion to Krishna. It was a pragmatic, protect his backside move, because he had offended Krishna and he knew that he was going to get it by the residents of Dwarka that loved Krishna, and he had offended Krishna. He had said these bad things about Krishna that weren't true. So he was going to get a big reaction. And so he gave the jewel and his daughter. Krishna said, "You keep the jewel, I'll take your daughter." And Krishna married Satyabhama. We'll hear the whole description this evening. The whole pastime. Anything else? Why did he do a bad thing? Why did he do a bad thing after that?
Yes, I want to just know, like, is prayer not an ideal path to always remember God?
There are 9 processes of bhakti, of which one is prayer. So prayer is part of the process of bhakti. So, knowing that, now reconsider your question. Prayer is an essential part of bhakti. It's one of the 9 principal angas of bhakti. So we certainly wouldn't say that prayer is not to be done. Prayer is to be done. But many people pray, but they don't know what to pray, nor do they even have a clear idea of to whom they're praying. In other words, to whom they're praying may be like the person in charge of a big warehouse. He's got lots of stuff, and I want some of the stuff he has in his warehouse. And that's why I pray. I want some of that stuff. So God is far more than a dispenser of things in his warehouse. So the conception that one has of God is elevated by the first 2 processes, or the first process, by hearing. So proper prayer follows behind, or is preceded by, hearing and chanting. And then you offer prayer. So in the beginning, it's advised, offer prayers that are given by pure devotees, because they know what to pray for, and they know who the person is that they're praying to. It's not bad. One can also offer individual prayer, but those individual prayers often will be skewed from without proper understanding of the person to whom we're praying, nor what is in our best interest to pray for what. Like a child, you know, I want a toy. So then you get an adult and it's, I want, you know, a big toy. If we don't have a proper understanding of the gift that God can give in through the medium of prayer. Prabhupada tells the story of a woman whose occupation, she lived in Vrindavan. And her occupation was, she would go to the forest, gather wood that had fallen to the ground, place the wood in a cloth, take the corners of the cloth, tie the corners together, and place the bundle on her head, and carry to the marketplace, and sell for whatever she could get, and that was her maintenance. Since she was very poor, the little pieces of wood made a big difference. So one day, as she was getting older, she did this her whole life. And she thought of Krishna because she lived in Vrindavan. And then one day the bundle fell off her head. She called out, "Krishna, please help me." So Krishna came, like Draupadi. Krishna came. And Krishna said, "What would you like?" He said, "Could you help me put the bundle back on my head?" If one understands who is Krishna, There are many things to ask Krishna for besides, please put the bundle back on my head. So I can then go to the marketplace and sell something and get some money so I can maintain myself. So prayer is very valuable. It's good to know what to pray for and who the person is who you're praying to. That comes from the hearing and chanting that precedes the prayer. And then you put them together in the mature stage, and it's all part of the ninefold process of bhakti. Why not? Why not? Have a good understanding of the whole house of bhakti. In your house, you have doorknobs. You have plumbing. You have bedrooms. You have a kitchen. So if you look after your house, you look after all the parts of your house, not just one thing. But the entrance into the realm of bhakti, the entry point, is hearing and chanting. And then the other parts become matured or nurtured. So the essential, the foundation, the essence, is hearing and chanting. Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu. So we immerse ourselves in that. Don't leave it. Stay with it. Grow it. Throughout your whole life. And then the other forms, the deity worship flows from that, hearing and chanting. Not that once you do deity worship, then you stop the hearing and chanting. It continues to nurture. Like this discussion of what Maharaj Pariksit prayed. I've already given my heart fully to the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. Please help me keep my heart there by hearing, by reciting the messages of Vishnu, his glories. So it's the beginning and it's the middle and it's the end. Like Prabhupada would sometimes say, what's the goal of chanting? More chanting. And so along with more chanting, then other expressions of bhakti. Becoming Krishna's friend, becoming fully surrendering everything unto Krishna and so forth. The other processes of bhakti flow from hearing and chanting.